Studio.
That's it.
Right? Studio.
360 with Kurt Anderson.
Kurt Anderson.
Kurt Anderson.
I listen to it on the radio in my car.
Now don't be sniffy about
I'm not being sniffy.
I think you are.
No.
You've got a nose for it.
Oh, gosh. Wow. What are you saying over there?
Today on the show, you know, they make typewriter keys sound like gunshots.
Oh, that's just somebody riffing.
Take me now, baby, here as I am. Hold me now, try to understand.
It is a bit rehearsed.
Keep listening. Stay right there. Don't go anywhere. Stay. Sit.
And now some thoughts from our conspiracy theorist in chief.
If you look at voter registration, you look at the dead people that are registered to vote, who vote.
His grandmother in Kenya said he was born in Kenya and she was there and witnessed the birth. Okay?
What was he doing having breakfast or whatever they were doing 3 months before the JFK assassination? Why are they doing that? Why is the father meeting with Lee Harvey Oswald?
Like Trump, Hollywood loves conspiracy theories. But Hollywood's tend to be less preposterous than President Trump's and presented as fiction. Sam Adams is a senior editor at Slate, and he's as big a fan of conspiracy movies as I am. He's also got a new podcast all about them called Conspiracy Thrillers Movie Club.
The thriller part is probably more important to me than the conspiracy thriller as far as what's in and what's out. The thriller is just a great structure for kind of the gradual accumulation of information and a kind of accompanying threat that swells the closer you get to the truth. And the conspiracy, the uncovering of a great conspiracy, is just kind of goes hand in hand at that.
So what we're going to do today is kind of a sampler of your podcast and play clips from some of the movies that you're doing whole episodes about. First off is The Manchurian Candidate, where Frank Sinatra plays an army captain whose whole platoon is captured during the Korean War and brainwashed by the communists, and they all end up part of a communist plot to take over the U.S. government. Right?
I think that that's a pretty good start. I mean, it's important to remember that as much as this movie is kind of associated with the Kennedy assassination now, that it came out before it. And in fact, Sinatra, who was a friend of Kennedy, had to kind of get Kennedy's blessing for the studio to proceed with it because it does center around a political assassination. And that was a touchy subject.
Yeah. Well, here, the clip we're going to play is Sinatra, who plays Major Bennett Marco, talking to his superior officer.
For the last 6 months, I've been driven nearly out of my mind by the same recurring dream.
The medical officer in charge.
What the hell does a medical corps know about intelligence work, Milt? I tell you, there's something phony going on. There's something phony about me, about Raymond Shaw, about the whole Medal of Honor business. For instance, when the psychiatrist asked me how I felt about Raymond Shaw, how I personally felt about him, and how the whole patrol felt about him, did you hear what I said? Did you really hear what I said? I said Raymond Shaw is the kindest, warmest, bravest, most wonderful human being I've ever known in my life. And even now I feel that way, this minute. And yet, somewhere in the back of my mind, something tells me it's not true. It's just not true.
That was Frank Sinatra in The Manchurian Candidate. So you did your first podcast about it. Do you think of it as the sort of prototype of this genre?
I do think of it as kind of the prototype of the modern conspiracy thriller. I mean, there are certainly dozens, if not hundreds, of movies before that about, you know, Nazi spies and secret agents and things like that. But what really brings it into its own is the psychological element that you see in that clip where Sinatra's character, Bennett Marco, is talking about, you know, I'm going out of my mind. And he knows this thing, but his conscious mind is telling him it's not so, but some part underneath him, something just feels wrong. And he's been, as we find out later, he's been brainwashed by the Chinese.
I think we know that from that clip.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But he can't put his finger on it. So he feels things that he knows not to be true, and he can't reconcile the two. And that element, where basically to know the truth, you have to indulge something that makes you feel crazy and makes other people think that you're crazy, is really what kind of defines the conspiracy thriller.
Yeah. It didn't immediately create a genre of these films, but let's fast forward to when it bloomed, the mid-1970s. This genre was everywhere. This is a clip from another movie with an assassination plot. It's The Parallax View, directed by the great Alan Pakula. Came out in 1974. What's the basic log line of The Parallax View?
Yeah, this is a real cornerstone of
the genre. This is about Warren Beatty, plays a reporter who is a witness to a political assassination at the beginning and stumbles onto this international syndicate of corporate assassins.
Well, here is Warren Beatty talking to Paula Prentice in Parallax View.
Since the assassination, six of these people have died in some kind of an accident.
Four. Look, nobody's trying to kill you, huh?
These people were killed. And whoever killed them is going to try to kill me. Austin Tucker thinks so, too. Austin thinks that maybe we all saw something up there.
That is a very common sort of plot thing in these movies of, we all saw something. It was right there, but we didn't notice what was going on, right?
Yeah, I mean, one of the key elements in the paranoid mindset, and this goes back to the paranoid style in American politics, that kind of classic 64 essay that really laid this mindset out, is
Richard Hofstadter, one of my heroes.
Yes. But he emphasizes in that one of the hallmarks of the paranoid style is that the evidence is kind of right in front of us, and it's just a matter of connecting the dots. The Parallax View came out in 74, which is right as Watergate was cresting. Alan Pakula then went on to make All the President's Men a couple years later, which is, of course, about Watergate. But it really institutionalized this notion that the tiniest, most insignificant things, this kind of third-rate burglary at a hotel in Washington, can really be the crack that opens up the door to this
the
tremendous—
The truth is out there.
Yes, exactly.
Another great film, also directed by Alan Pakula, as you mentioned, came out in 1976, which was the story of the Washington Post exposing Watergate, All the President's Men. And maybe you don't even need to describe what that is, but it's that, right?
Yes, yes, exactly. It's All the President's Men. I think this is, of all the movies in the series, probably the one that people at least know of the best.
Let's play this clip.
Mitchell started doing covert stuff before anyone else. The list is longer than anyone can imagine. It involves the entire U.S. intelligence community, FBI, CIA, and justice. It's incredible. Cover-up had little to do with Watergate. It was mainly to protect the covert operations. It leads everywhere. Get out your notebook. There's more. Your lives are in danger.
I literally got goosebumps right now sitting here listening to that clip.
Yeah, it's such a great scene, and it really—
It was Hal Holbrook, by the way, as Deep Throat, who, we didn't know this until recently, but was the number two guy in the FBI at the time.
Right, and just this, I think if you've ever seen the movie or even that clip, you can't help but picture the setting of this dark garage where they're meeting. It's so ominous. They're surrounded by this empty space that you feel like another character could step into at any moment. They're not safe. That sense of danger is omnipresent, and that line, "It leads everywhere," is just so key to this mindset that, you know, everyone is involved. Everything is a conspiracy.
All the President's Men, I think, is the only film on your list so far that's entirely and pretty scrupulously about and consisting of historical fact, right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, they were very scrupulous about sticking as close to the real story as possible, to the point of spending $500,000 in 1973 money to rebuild the Washington Post newsroom on a soundstage, and got trash shipped out from the Post to put in the waste baskets. It has a somewhat different texture from the other movies in that, you know, you don't have scenes in the other movies of people kind of knocking on doors and crossing names off lists, because that stuff is traditionally not cinematic.
Yes. It's not life with the boring bits taken out, as Hitchcock said.
Yeah.
It's the boring bits.
But the miracle of it is that they managed to make, you know, they make typewriter keys sound like gunshots, and they really bring home how powerful this sometimes very boring job can be.
I have wondered lately and thought about and written about, actually, how and if these great films of the 60s and 70s, these conspiracy thrillers, actually played a real and significant role in oversensitizing Americans to the idea that everything bad is the result of conspiracy. Do you think so?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, I think people have certainly talked about how even just the existence of Woodward and Bernstein in the 70s kind of created a whole generation of journalists who are expecting to find their own deep throat and take down a presidency. And it creates this
unrealistic expectations for the public in how solid the information will be. I mean, that happens with, you know, real-life conspiracies are rarely as well-orchestrated or as seductive as the ones in movies. So we sort of impose these narratives on top of them and get a very false picture of what's really going on.
Yes. The most recent movie on your list is Jordan Peele's fantastic Get Out. This is a clip from that film in which the star, played by Daniel Kaluuya, telephones his friend back home to talk about his misgivings about his white girlfriend's family whom he's visiting.
I didn't want to tell you.
What?
I got hypnotized last night.
Nigga, get the fuck out of here.
Yo, to quit smoking, but it's Rose's mom's a psychiatrist, so.
Bruh, I don't care if the bitch is Ayanna Van Zant, okay? She can't fix my motherfucking life. You ain't getting in my head.
I know she called me off guard, right? But it's cool, because I'm cured. It worked.
Bro, how you not scared of this, man? Look, they could have made you do all types of stupid shit. They have you fucking barking like a dog.
Flying around like you a fucking pigeon.
Looking ridiculous, okay? Or, I don't know if you know this, white people love making people sex slaves and shit.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they're not a kinky sex family, dog.
That was Daniel Kaluuya and Lil Rel Howery in Get Out. We will avoid giving too much of a spoiler for a movie that hasn't been out very long especially, but what are the elements in this horror film that make it a conspiracy thriller?
Well, yeah, well, this, as I mentioned, I kind of warped the definition of the traditional conspiracy a little bit to mix things up and to just talk about some movies I wanted to talk about. And this is, I think, the furthest out from that. It is, you know, more of a kind of horror thriller. Jordan Peele, the writer-director, has kind of, I think, coined the phrase social thriller to refer to it. It, you know, it lacks the larger political element that we usually think of it as being part of a conspiracy.
Because it's a small group of people.
Yes. So, yeah, it's again, without giving too much away, but it is a conspiracy that's just based in one small town.
And I think people know, and perhaps that clip should have told them, it's a conspiracy of white people in which black people are the victims.
Yeah, but this is a movie in which, like The Stepford Wives, which is the 1975 movie that Peele is cited as his biggest influence, it's a movie in which we have this one very small conspiracy. It's I mean, it's kind of like society is the conspiracy. I mean, what's going on in this small town is very obviously and transparently a reflection of kind of institutional, really liberal racism across the country. And I think that audiences who keyed into the film very much sense that. So it is about kind of history or society as a conspiracy rather than something deliberately orchestrated.
Well, and because Jordan Peele made the conspiracy deliberately outlandish, it allowed it, even though it's beautifully realistic in many ways as well, to be a great allegory, right?
Right. I mean, one of the interesting things about conspiracy thrillers is they indulge kind of our darkest fears, but there is also something strangely comforting about them in the sense that they tell us that, you know, we actually are right when we think that things are wrong around us. And they tell us that someone is in charge, you know, that all these crazy things that are happening in the world, they are happening for a reason, even if we don't understand it. And it is, you know, maybe in some way comforting to think that systemic racism is the product of, you know, a small group of conspiring white people who, I don't think it gives too much about the way about the end of the movie, can be vanquished.
It's interesting that you mentioned the comfort of conspiracism, the comfort of that kind of paranoia. But back in 1973, in Gravity's Rainbow, the great Thomas Pynchon paranoid conspiracy thriller of its time, he talks a lot about that very thing of that we can't live without a certain amount of believing that there are people in control, because like that's really scary if nobody's in control.
Right. And I think that, you know, history shows us that's often closer to the truth, that there really is no one minding the store. And in some cases, the things aren't conspiracies because they don't need to be. You know, society is set up in such a way that people don't need to actively conspire with each other because they all kind of know their roles.
Sam Adams, this has been great. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You can listen for free to the first episode of Sam's podcast, Conspiracy Thrillers Movie Club, at slate.com. Next, why videos of theatrical improv comedy performances don't quite land.
It's like NHL hockey. It's just so much better when you're there. You feel like, oh, they could fall and get hurt.
I talk with Matt Walsh, one of the stars of Veep, about making ad-libs work on the stage and on the screen. That's coming up in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Studio 360.
Yeah, yeah, directors are auteurs, and screenwriters can be precious about their scripts. But some of the most quoted lines in cinema were improvised by actors.
He's looking at you, kid.
Here's Johnny.
You talking to me? You talking to me?
Hey, I'm walking here. I'm walking here.
All those classic lines were made up on movie sets on the fly. Filmmakers from Robert Altman to Christopher Guest to Judd Apatow have famously given their actors free rein to ad-lib lines, resulting at their best in thrillingly naturalistic or surprising or funny moments. But movies and TV are so painstakingly storyboarded, choreographed moment by moment. So in the midst of all that planning, where does the spontaneity come in? The perfect person to help us understand that is Matt Walsh, who improvises all the time on the set of the HBO comedy Veep, in which he plays the press secretary, Mike McClintock.
Gary, what do you think of the new cut, huh? Do you like it?
Of course I don't fucking like it, Gary. It's the worst use of scissors since my failed vasectomy.
The elfin look is in right now. I was reading about it.
People don't elect elves, okay? They put them to work in grottos or they get them drunk at frat parties so they can toss them.
Okay, that's dwarves.
It doesn't matter.
Matt Walsh is also a founding member of what's become the center of the improv industrial complex, the Upright Citizens Brigade.
Those clips of iconic film moments, I did not know that those were ad-libs. Like, that's very fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And do you know, I mean, historically, how it went from this form of warming up and let's just mess around here to being synonymous in the last half century with comedy?
My simplest sort of answer would perhaps be the type of directors who have achieved success recently, like Adam McKay or Judd Apatow or Todd Phillips. Like, these are guys that are friendly to the ad-lib line or want some improv on set. So
right.
In terms of comedy, I think part of it is that graduation of those guys into like mainstream film.
It would seem as if improv comedy is designed to be performed live, trapeze, you know,
yes.
Tight wire kind of stuff.
The ability to fail like is real. You feel it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you can't really fail. I mean, you can fail on camera, but you can't fail in that in the moment because you can do it over again. So how does that work, improving when they're shooting you?
So my experience in general is usually there's a good script for a comedy, and then you get to moments where that aren't working, and then there's a little powwow with the director and the writer, and then they'll talk about ideas, and they'll give you free rein, like, okay, play with this one. Or you've captured what's been filmed already, and they'll give you what's called a free take, and you can just mess around and discover other things or create things that will never end up in the movie, and sometimes they do.
So are there things that killed on stage at Upright Citizens Brigade, the UCB, but when you try to do them in Veep, for instance, it just doesn't work at all being filmed?
That's a good point. I think the lines that work or that stick in a movie are lines that come from the character, like their point of view or their perspective, or you're improvising on story. Like, the things that don't get used in movies is when you're sort of riffing and you're doing a riff about somebody's penis size or how much they masturbate, like those sort of easy
and who does
low-hanging who does? Fruit. But that is sort of a low-hanging fruit gimmick, if you will.
Yes.
It's not on story, and it's not likely to make the cut. Or if they end up in the movie, you can kind of see it and go, oh, that's just somebody riffing. So if you're going to try to get something in the film, try to improvise on story or try to improvise something unique and say it uniquely like that character speaks.
Yeah. I've been to improv, live improv, and I find myself laughing hilariously at something and then realize when I try to tell somebody about it, like, no, I guess you had to be there to realize why that was funny. Does that happen a lot?
It is true. It's like NHL hockey. It's just so much better when you're there as opposed to watching it on television.
And people get hurt, too.
And there is fights. I think it's the reality, kind of like what you talked about, is you feel in the trapeze, like you feel like, oh, they could fall and get hurt. We wouldn't get hurt, but you, when you're in the room, you feel like, oh, there's a real chance of failure, and they're really trying to keep the ball up in the air here. And when you see it on television, I think audiences assume like, well, you can fix it in post, and they probably, you can write it, you can cheat. So they don't get that sense of danger.
So it seems like a contradiction, but how do you prepare to do improvisation?
I think in Veep world, you just sort of rehearse it and talk about it. Like, I don't want to say this, can I say this? And the writers will have alt lines, and it's a very fluid, and you're always just trying to make it feel messy and like sort of real spontaneity, even though it's scripted. So it is a bit rehearsed.
As your showrunner, Dave Mandel, here called it, he says, that's when we zhuzh it up.
That is the word. I was trying not to say that. I think that's a Julia thing, when you zhuzh it up.
And yeah.
I can't define that word, but...
Nor could Dave.
For us, what it means is, let's say we have a scene where it's two characters are talking. Things sometimes just start to get a little rote, a little line. Hello, how are you? I'm fine. That's great. That's not how we talk. Even right here on, you know, you and I talking on this interview, we're trying to stay out of each other's way, but occasionally we're talking over each other. And that's what zhuzhing is. That's what messing it up is. And it's a real hallmark of Veep.
From the interview I did with your Veep head writer, Dave Mandel.
Yes. What I think we do well on the show is they make it seem sloppy and messy and like unintentional.
Right.
But so much choreography and so much rehearsal goes into getting that.
Right.
So.
No, it's sort of like Robert Altman, although I assume unlike those movies, you're not all high all the time, probably.
I would have loved to have done a film with Robert Altman. I met a woman who was a makeup artist for him, and I was just grilling her because he had since passed. And she said he equated filmmaking to, and maybe it's been in one of his books, but he said it's like making an elaborate sandcastle in that all this effort goes into one moment and then it's gone. Like it'll just wash away. Like we have the set, the actors are there, and then it goes away. That's so this intense effort for an elaborate sandcastle.
That's very Eastern and Zen in its notion. So let's listen to you in action in the cinema. Here is a moment I'm told you improvised in the movie Elf, which starred Will Ferrell. You play this random guy being interviewed on the local news after seeing Santa's sleigh.
Yeah.
Sir, what did you see?
I think you're great, Charlotte. I saw something fall from the sky right in the middle of Central Park. I mean, you're a great news lady.
Thank you. Could you tell me a bit more about what you saw fall from the sky?
Yeah. Your eyes tell the story. That's what I love about you. You got a great mouth. The thing just dropped in the middle of Central Park. It was amazing.
How much of that was on the page?
That was directed by Jon Favreau, and I think before that scene, the dialogue is basically, I have to say that I saw Santa in Central Park. I had a few lines and the reporter a few lines, and then Favreau was like, why don't you hit on her? He just sort of gave me a general point of like, why don't you hit on her while she's interviewing you? I'm like, great. And then I think I sort of pitched him a couple ways, like, what would you say? And I threw out a couple examples. He's like, go in that direction, but it wasn't scripted.
Right.
And so we sort of had an idea of like, I'm going to hit on her. And I kind of have a world of lines, I might say. And then all the while still delivering the lines that are on the page.
Well, which is you know, increasing your degree of difficulty a lot. I mean, okay, I got to remember the lines. I have to act. And now I have to be funny.
Yeah, but it's more fun because it wasn't probably a super funny scene as written. And I think that's what the director was picking up on. So he's happened to be an improv guy to Chicago, too. Uh-huh. So he knew that there was something else in there. So... he gives you license to do that.
Was that one take or how did
No, that we did different versions. I think I said I hit on her another way, or I asked her if she got high, like in one take. Just like really stopping the interview.
Yeah.
You know what's funny too is I think on the early takes, I don't think she knew I was going to be improvising. So it's sort of like tricking or messing with your scene partner. Yeah. But
pulling a gun.
Yeah. In the middle of the scene. Stay in character.
Here's another scene in another Will Ferrell movie that you improvised called Semi-Pro, 2008 movie. Will Ferrell plays a basketball player, Jackie Moon. His mother had recently died. You play this referee who's called Father Pat. Here is the scene from the movie.
traveling.
No. 1.5 steps.
Come on, Jackie. You walk.
Suck my cock. I'll murder your family.
You're gone, Jackie Moon.
What? Jackie Moon is ejected from the game.
What did I say?
You said S my C. You're a big baby, Jackie.
Jackie Moon and the referee really going at it here.
I didn't say anything.
You said S my C.
I barely raised my voice.
I should call your mother.
You need a phone to heaven to do that.
Maybe your mom didn't go to heaven.
Oh, dear. Oh, my.
Look, Jackie, I'm sorry.
Stop the broadcast.
Jackie Moon is pulling his team off the court.
You forfeit this game, Jackie, if you keep walking.
That's fine.
You threatened to kill my family.
Maybe your mom didn't go to heaven is a great line. Was that just in the moment?
Yes, that was Kent Alterman directed that film. And by the way, semi-pro funnier than people think. That's a funny scene.
I've only now seen the clips that you were in. I never saw the film.
Yeah. I believe, if memory serves, that scene was me ejecting Jackie from the game. And Will Ferrell obviously is so great throwing a tantrum or just getting really worked up. So I think I would guess the first two or three exchanges were scripted. And then once it elevated, it just was improvised. And then we probably repeated it two or three times. But I would imagine, like, saying your mom didn't go to heaven probably just happened in the last take.
Was the movie recrafted to, like, whoa, this is great, we're going to do this differently because
I think we serve the plot, and the plot is right. Written in the script is like Jackie gets ejected from the game and throws a small tantrum, right. Punts the ball. So that was still in there. What they had were these extra moments of like the continued exchange, S my C,
yes.
All of that stuff.
And what about S my C, which again just makes me laugh for that somebody would say that in the heat of the moment.
I think that probably came from earlier. I think that was something like back in my UCB days, we would say to each other, like, as a way of being polite, hey, man, why don't you S my C? So it wasn't like a new phrasing I came up with. That was something I'd said before with friends.
Well, that's really interesting because that's exactly what I expect. Like, jazz players have played a certain riff before, but this is the moment I can use that.
Yeah, and it applied to that. And I didn't know he was going to say suck my whatever. So it worked out perfectly. Yeah.
We've talked repeatedly about Veep. I want to talk about your role, Mike McClintock, White House Press Secretary, and now former White House Press Secretary, I guess. Mm-hmm. That show really uses improv. It's baked into the making, right?
As far as improv goes, it gets used mostly in the rehearsal process. We'll read the table read, and then we'll workshop them, and then the successive drafts will reflect discoveries and things we did in rehearsal.
But rehearsal at a table or rehearsal standing up and acting?
Well, what it'll be is we'll be in the writer's office, and we'll turn the kitchen into an airport lobby, or we'll use the hallway by the writer's room, and we'll pretend it's the White House or the Oval. If there's a speaking role that somebody's not there, that other actors will step in. So I get to play a senator, or I get to play like the Qatari ambassador. And so we get to like be the sounding board for the characters who are also in that scene.
Well, that sounds like some,
it's like theater camp. It's really fun.
Utopian dream of what it's supposed to be like.
It really is. And it's a very unique process. There's not many shows where I've been able to do that.
Here is a clip from Veep season 4, episode called Testimony. The characters are being questioned by this congressional committee investigating a computer data breach. This is your scene.
They saw you in the White House parking lot with Mr. Egan, Ms. Bruckheimer, and Senator Pierce.
That's correct. I ran into them by chance because I was merely getting something from my car.
What were you getting?
I'm sorry?
What were you getting?
I was getting some medicine.
What kind of medicine?
It's knee medicine.
Knee medicine?
Yeah, knee medicine for one of my knees.
Which one?
Which knee? My left knee, Your Honor, sir. My left knee. I have problems with my left knee. It hurts when I crouch.
What was the name of the medicine?
I want to say it's called crouch cream, but that's not right. It's a white tube with a red label. I'm sure an intern could research this. It has a silhouette of a horse on it. And I don't know why the horse is on there. I guess horses probably have good knees. So, but I think it's called Knee-Z cream. I don't think that's it. It's searchable. I'm very positive.
The fact that they used that whole thing in the show is extraordinary. How improvised was that?
That's a fascinating episode. So that's an episode where I think we shot like 58 pages that day. And Armando created this congressional hearing room.
Armando Iannucci, the creator.
Yeah. Everybody in there, even the cameramen, were dressed as aides. And so you were kept off set. It was like a murder mystery theater. He really kind of messed with us in the best way. So he gave us this living set, and we were being interviewed. And we had scripts that we could put down. But basically, in that section, the bit was about knee cream, and Mike would describe the bottle. But everything else, you're just sort of being really – so you walk in the room, and you're extremely nervous because everyone's looking at you. And you sit down, and my sort of direction for my character is like, be really nervous and be really sweaty. So I just held on to that, and then I tried to make my way through, like, the knee cream bit and then ad-libbing things to get to the next bit, if that makes sense.
Well, and like the intern, you can look at it, it's searchable.
That probably an offhand line. Yeah, that's probably an ad-lib.
Again, made me laugh. Maybe you don't have anxiety when you improv at this point, having done it for decades. But I would think that the inherent anxiety of improv would be perfect for this character who's like nervous and doesn't know what he's going to say.
Yeah.
Right?
It's wonderful. It's like you basically are put in this scenario where you can't drop character. Once you're dropped into that fake testimonial, but everyone's playing that game, you, no matter what happens, don't drop that character.
Right.
Don't drop that point of view.
So totally method
improv. I love
improv.
That. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
I really do.
Yeah. Well, you've maintained your character so far in this interview very, very nicely.
What is that character?
The friendly, loquacious, cooperative actor, writer.
Okay. That is my character.
Matt Walsh, thanks so much for doing this.
This was fun.
The seventh season of Veep begins, well, next year in 2018. But I'm sure you can watch all of the wonderful past episodes of the last six seasons on HBO. You can also watch Matt Walsh in the new movie Brigsby Bear, which was a big hit at Sundance and opens all over America on the 28th of July. Coming up, Jimmy from the Hood. In fact, my hood.
Isn't it wonderful? I remember I saw my first Playboy magazine right off the corner of Bobby of Leone's house.
The rise of Jimmy Iovine, from Brooklyn kid to music industry mogul. That's up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Studio 360. You're kidding.
We're on the same block, man. That's where you grew up?
I grew up. My whole life was spent on that street.
That's amazing.
Is that freaky? I got
that
goosebumps
is totally
now.
Freak. I know 3A, because they're those Victorian houses.
Yeah.
This is music industry mogul Jimmy Iovine, who I learned as soon as he sat down in our studio, grew up on the very same block in Brooklyn where I've lived for 27 years.
No. The only thing came out of our neighborhood was my cousin, Roseanne Scamandella.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Right.
That was my cousin. Right. She lived there.
Her pictures are still like in some of the delis and stuff.
Is right? That right?
Oh, yeah. Roseanne Scamandella, New Yorkers might remember as a local news anchor in the late 70s and early 80s. Her cousin, Jimmy, turned out to be an even bigger deal. He co-founded Interscope Records and more recently teamed up with Dr. Dre to launch Beats, the headphone company and streaming service, which they sold recently to Apple.
I came out of Brooklyn without an education and without a lot of, you know, feel or culture for that, you know, or understanding of the arts or anything like that. You know, I was in a band, but that was about it, you know?
Jimmy Iovine's music education started in the 1970s when he was 19 and a junior recording engineer. His job, setting up microphones and working a soundboard, wasn't glamorous until suddenly, fortuitously, it was.
I learned from John Lennon, Bruce Springsteen, and John Landau, which was Bruce's manager. And when you, that, it was so condensed, because when you make an album with someone, you're together 12 hours a day, at least 6 days a week, you know. So I did six albums with those people, you know, combined. And I came out of there having a feel for what would go, but yet would still with credibility.
Right.
What could hit.
Right.
But yet still
everybody's proud of.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So when you were as a, 22-year-old, 23-year-old working with Patti Smith 40 years ago, did you have a at that moment, did you have a conception of what the audience would respond to her? Because she was a cult figure at best.
Remember, I just came out of Lennon and Springsteen, so I watched the poetry thing be really big. So I had high hopes for Patti.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine. Milner, pot of thieves, wild card of my sleeve.
So I said, why isn't sky the limit on this thing, you know? So at a moment I said, so, you know, Patti, we have this great album, but we don't have a single. You know, we don't have a song to make people that don't know you get into the album.
And she didn't say, why are you trying to make me sell out, you suit?
Yeah. Well, I wasn't a suit, but I was.
You were a salesman.
I was, yes, I was a salesman without a suit.
Yeah.
By the way, right before that, I worked in the Leading Mail in Brooklyn, and I was selling suits. So that's where it all kind of came together. So I went to her, and she said, I do my own music, man. I don't do one of the people. So I said, look, Bruce has this song that he's not going to use. And I think if you finished it, the lyrics, I think it's going to be so powerful. I can't tell you it's going to be a hit. I can just tell you it's going to be powerful. A woman singing those lyrics, you know, desire is hunger is the fire I breathe, you know, and because the night belongs to lovers, you know, take me now, baby, here as I am, hold me now, try to understand. I mean, a woman singing those lyrics was so powerful.
And hadn't happened, really. I mean,
in the old days, right. You'd have like the Shangri-Las. But in the rock and roll, not at that moment punk was happening, you know?
Well, so you had this tape from the famous Bruce Springsteen, your friend, and you gave it to her and said...
I begged her to listen to it. It took about a month for her to listen to it.
Well, let's listen to it. Here's that tape.
How'd you get that? That's the original demo.
Yeah.
Wow, that's when we cut that record the same day as Fire. He had 70 songs for Darkness on the Edge of Town, and we cut that record. Man, working in the hot sun, I remember those lyrics, man.
Was she resistant, Patti Smith? Because, Bruce Springsteen is this big, giant star now, and I'm different, and we have a different sensibility, or what was...
Well, they had a Jersey competitiveness as well.
Of course, South Jersey competitiveness.
Right,
yeah.
So, you know, they had that going on.
Right.
And, but I just, I learned the, I started to learn the art of persuasion, you know, and I just kept on it, you know, like my father used to tell me all the time when my mother would drive us all crazy, he says, no one hammers a nail like your mother. And I think I got it from her.
Well, this turned in, of course, to Patti Smith's big hit.
Take me now, baby, here as I am. Pull me close, try and understand. Desire is hunger, is the fire I breathe. Love is a banquet on which we feed. Come on now, try and understand.
So even though Patti Smith was reluctant to record that, it became... more popular than any song she made before or since. I think her only top 20 hit. And right when it came out in 1978, hip-hop was emerging up in the Bronx. When did you start paying attention to that?
My first introduction to rap was Run DMC, but I really still wasn't paying attention. My first moment was when Dre and Suge walked into my office and played me The Chronic, because I didn't understand hip-hop records, because I was a fanatic, meticulous recording engineer. And those records were made really sloppy, the early hip-hop records, on purpose.
Yep.
But I still didn't understand the whole subwoofer thing and the 808 and all that stuff. So when he came in, it was like somebody gave me 3D glasses. So I was like, whatever this guy's doing, I've got to get in business with him.
1, 2, 3 into the folk. Snoop Doggy Dogg and Dr. Dre is at the dope, ready to make an entrance, so back on up.
I guess you just started Interscope at that point.
Yeah.
And you put out Dr. Dre's album.
The Chronic out, yeah.
Which featured a lot of Snoop Dogg. Trouble ain't nothing but a G-thang, baby. Too low depth, so get over crazy. Death Row is the label that pays me. Unfadable, so please don't try to fake this. But back to the lecture at hand.
When I heard the lyrics and I saw what they were doing, they reminded me of Mick and Keith.
You said that a lot at the time. It was very clever.
It just does. It reminded me because they scare you, but they bring you in with their music. I remember going to Jan Winter and saying to him, man, this is Mick and Keith. Put them on the cover.
The editor of Rolling Stone, who at that time, I probably had never had a rap artist.
No,
yeah.
No. MTV was the same way. They weren't playing gangster rap during the day, or they only played on MTV raps.
Yeah. And radio stations were not playing single, nothing but a G-thang.
Nothing like that.
And so you went out and bought time and just played a minute of the song on
That's
a lot
what
of stations.
I did. I told my promotion people, I said, look, this has got to get on the radio. So buy a 1 minute spot. Don't do any of that stuff. Just play the goddamn thing. And before you know it, the phones exploded and people had to play it. But that's what led to the record getting in the hands of kids that were going home to like congressmen and all this kind of stuff. And we caught a lot of heat at Interscope.
Well, you did, but you all, first of all, it must have been fun to basically say, screw you to you stations that won't play this. You're playing it because I'm paying you.
Yeah.
But, and of course, you know, Tipper Gore and everybody in Washington, oh my God, listen to read these lyrics. It's terrible. But the other thing that happened that you had a big part in doing is making rap music the cool thing for every 16-year-old white boy in American suburbs.
Well, Dre was a phenomenon, and we had him at the same time as Tupac and Snoop. And I knew we had the basis of something extraordinary. So what I did was back it. And I backed it because I knew it would go international as well. Like, I remember my promotion guy saying to me, we're never going to get this record on the radio. I said, they're going to be dancing to this in China. And everybody looked at me like I was nuts. It just caught me like that. Caught me like the wind. It just caught me. It hit me in the chest. And I said, I didn't discover this stuff, but I'll tell you what, we are going to take this international. And we were, who knows what part of it we were, but we were part of that.
I've been saying for a while that hip hop and rap were the last big new invention of American pop culture. Do you agree with that?
Feels that way to me. Feels that way to me. I mean, something's got to give. Right now, it's tough.
Yeah. Lots of people, most people probably, get stuck with a lot of the music tastes they develop between age 15 and 25, and they don't change. Are you just a guy who naturally would have kept discovering music, or you realized, this is my profession. I got to keep my ears open to new.
Yeah, well, what happened was in the late 80s, I realized that I wasn't a natural at producing anymore, actually in the studio, because I started getting older. And in the 70s and early 80s, it was very natural for me to walk. I knew exactly what to tell the band. I knew exactly what we were doing. As soon as I felt a little bit of that, I said, I'm going to make a label and I'll be able to work with the younger people and learn about the cutting edge of what's happening in music today.
And you did that before you were actually old, when you were barely...
Well, it felt old to me. What I mean?
You were older than the artist.
I was 37.
Artists. Yeah.
I was older than the artist.
Another big Interscope band after that was the rap rock group Limp Bizkit. This is... So that's Limp Bizkit rolling. I think it's pretty safe to say that the Cognoscenti won't say that stands the test of time the way Patti Smith and Bruce Springsteen and Dr. Dre do.
You're right. The music, they still go out there and play, I think, but it's not like the stuff you're talking
about.
Well,
I remember you saying, I was reminded that you said at the time that Fred Durst, the frontman, was like Oscar Wilde and William S. Burroughs. Really?
Did I say that?
According to a Guardian article in 2000, you did. But anyway, in the 2000s, a generation after you'd signed Dr. Dre, he became your partner in Beats, the headphone company and streaming service, which in 2014 you sold to Apple for $3 billion. So now are you an Apple Music employee?
Yeah, I am an Apple employee now.
Do you go to Cupertino and show up?
I go to Cupertino once a week. And we're building a music service. Right now, music needs an elegant way for people to find music, to understand it. And the services are close, but they even need more work to become a really of service rather than just a utility. And that's what people need. People need a way right now to discover artists, to share with their friends, to do it and to communicate with artists. Artists need a way to communicate with their audience. And that's what I think streaming services will really catch once that happens.
Yeah. Although, you know, Spotify and Pandora are doing a decent job at what they're doing.
We're at around 30 million people as
well.
Yeah,
yeah. Streaming.
By the way, 30 million people is almost as much as Sirius Radio.
Right.
For example.
Right. Yeah. You know. Yeah. Let's listen to a very popular band, streaming band. These are the Chainsmokers.
Hey, I was doing just fine before I met you. I drink too much and that's an issue, but I'm okay. Hey, you tell your friends it was nice to meet them, but I hope I never see them again.
Now, am I just being a fogey, or are streaming audiences these days more into that kind of nice, untroubling? Blah, blah.
I can tell you that paid streaming, Spotify paid and Apple paid, the top 20 are 80% hip hop.
So unpaid is what I used to call bubblegum music when I was a kid.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of that going on mainstream radio, and it's pop is getting there streaming wise. It's no slouch, and this record was top 10 or top 5 streaming wise, but it's primarily the top end is and it's worldwide, by the
That's
way.
That's interesting. Why is that?
Because I think a lot of people listen to hip hop first, people that get on things earlier, and I think Drake and Kendrick Lamar really understand how to communicate with their audience. And especially somebody like Drake and Future to Prince, his manager, they really understand how to move music through this system, you know? And so their audience follows them there, you know? And so
the people who like the free, the people who like the poppier stuff, it's not unlike when we were young, the difference between top 40 and like album-oriented FM. I mean, those kinds of bifurcations always existed.
Well, you know, it's right now people want to be famous as much as they want to be great.
Unfortunately.
You know? And
or
that's,
more sometimes.
Well, that's the thing. So, you know, it's a tough time for music.
So, since you're brilliantly helping Apple navigate the waters of music, why don't you help them make a new breakthrough product?
Because I have no idea how to do that. it takes somebody much more talented than me, like the guys up there.
Jimmy Iovine, this has been a real pleasure. I thank you.
And a great pleasure for me.
Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre are the subjects of a new 4-part HBO documentary called The Defiant Ones. Wow, that was fantastic.
The fact that you lived there. Isn't it wonderful? I mean, I saw my first Playboy magazine right off the corner of Bobby of the Leone's house.
And that's it for the show this week. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our executive producer is
Jocelyn Gonzalez.
Our senior editor is
Andrew Adam Newman.
Our technical director is
Lily Mitchell.
Our producers are
Daniel Guimet,
Sam Kim,
Skylar Swenson,
Tommy Bizarrian,
Zoe Saunders.
And our intern is
Claude Gillette.
I'm Kurt Anderson. Thank you very much for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.
next time in Studio 360, the novel that brought white America face to face with racism.
Richard Wright was saying, let's stop asking for permission. Let's stop selling ourselves. Let's stop apologizing. If you're angry and you know it, clap your hands. You know?
I'm Kurt Anderson, Richard Wright's native son. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.